You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 331, our 39th Q&A. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, what's going on?
Well, it's hot here.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah. And hot to you is?
Well, I mean, I grew up in Pennsylvania, so, you know, I know what 90s weather is and high humidity, but nobody else other than my wife and myself, you know, nobody else in the house has really experienced that. So it's kind of like a thing that's really noticeable to them.
Are they melting? Yeah. Are they complaining? Well, I mean, what's going on?
No, I mean, my oldest, you know, Amy, she likes to go out and sit outside and whatnot. Calvin hates it. You know, Simi sort of ambivalent. You know, she can sort of take it or leave it. But yeah, you know, Drina likes it. She says in Florida, it's like being, she still feels like she's on vacation every day, you know, yeah. Because it's like the sun, you know, like we went to a place sunny. That's, you know, we would only do that if we were on vacation, you know, like if you're in Washington State mode. So that's what it feels like to her.
Well, come talk to me when you hit triple digits, because Texas.
Yeah, we've seen that in New Mexico. Yeah. We've taken a couple of Roswell trips, you know, so, but there it's dry. Yeah. I don't know what that's going to be like when it's 100 here and it's like 90% humidity, or I guess you just don't go anywhere.
I wonder what the aliens feel about the hot weather in New Mexico.
Yeah.
I bet they have a lot of sunscreen.
That's probably, they just crashed. They didn't really stick around, or they can live underground in the underground base, you know.
Probably why they crashed. It was so hot. Their air conditioning went out. Their AC went out and they crashed. I guarantee you that's what happened.
Yeah. Maybe we reverse engineered their air conditioning to improve our own.
That's exactly right. Get more efficient. We're on to something, Mike.
That makes so much sense.
You're flying around in the sun, you know, close to the sun and all these stars. You got to have a good AC. And then the reverse, right? You got to have good heat when you're out in the middle of the cold, out in the empty space. You got to have good heat.
Yeah.
So
yeah, They've perfected climate control.
Yeah. Insulation. Perfect. That's exactly. Probably that new foam spray that you get in your house now, aliens.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
You know, if it's useful, we have to give them credit for it. I guess that's how that works.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Mike, anything else?
Somebody tells me I'll be getting an email from Coast to Coast AM this week about being on the show. Yeah, well, if somebody listens to this conversation.
I haven't listened to Coast to Coast in a while. Have you?
No, I haven't. And I haven't been on for probably 3 years. You know?
Well, you need to get on there for your demons book.
I don't know. George is just going to want to talk about ancient aliens. That's, you know, doesn't matter what the topic is. So, you know, plus now that I'm on the East Coast, it's like 1 a.m. to, or the show would be like 2 a.m. to 5 or something. It's like, do I really want to do that? Well, with this scintillating introduction to our Q&A.
Might as well get.
I'm sure right people are really, really. Yeah, let's get into the Q&A now, please. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I wish we had an alien question to start it off with, but we don't. But.
Well, are you sure? You can search through the archive for the word alien. You might find one.
That's true. I can make one up.
I got them in Q&A at the Awakening School stuff. You know, we tried to discourage that, but every once in a while, one would get through. You know.
Yeah. You got to at least try.
It is what it is.
You got to at least try. Yep. All right. Well. Let's just jump in here. Our first question is from Vuyo from Butterworth, South Africa. I know I didn't get your name, do it justice, but Vuyo, that's pretty neat. He said in the email, it was a small town called Butterworth in South Africa. So it's pretty neat. All right.
Yeah. I wonder if Mrs. Butterworth. Okay, I couldn't
do what?
Couldn't resist that. You can edit that if Mrs. Butterworth lives Butterworth there.
You know, I got you the syrup. Okay, I got you. Yeah, all right,
you can get rid of that later. So.
Okay. All right. Well, Vuyo I have a question concerning the Deuteronomy 32 cosmic geography worldview and its foundation being founded on the proper translation being sons of God, as opposed to sons of Israel. I am more in favor of sons of God. It's more coherent and fits the mosaic of the story of the Bible, but your argument for that is my concern. I don't think it's incorrect, but is it not possible for God, with his omniscience, with his foreknowledge, to be able to foreknow the number of the sons of Israel and thus divide the nations according to that number and thus maybe have sons of Israel as correct? How would you debunk that?
Oh, well, there's several ways. First of all, God's foreknowledge and omniscience has nothing to do with what the text actually says. Okay, there is no early textual evidence for sons of Israel. The oldest textual evidence we have, Dead Sea Scrolls, is sons of God, and whatever was behind the Septuagint, again, same thing. So none of that has anything to do with omniscience. The text is what it is, was what it was, regardless of that. So we can't wonder about what how we might approach an incorrect reading or a reading that didn't exist when the book was composed in light of God's attributes. That would be it's actually a nonsensical question in that regard. So again, I'll try to rephrase it so it's more clear, but our theological musings about something that wasn't in the Bible to begin with doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So that's the first thing. Moving on from that point, there are a couple of things that could easily be said here. There were more than 70 children of Israel that went down to Egypt. Let's just start there. The 70 in verses referring to that pilgrimage is not an actual number. It's actually artificial. You say, well, what do you mean by that? Well, when we did the series on Exodus, you know, we talked about Exodus 1:5, and I'm going to read that. So Exodus 1:5, let me look that up quick. Reading from the ESV again says, all the descendants of Jacob were 70 persons. Joseph was already in Egypt. Okay, so there you get the reference to the number 70. And when we talked about that on the podcast series on Exodus, I noted that descendants, which is literally those who came out of or out of the loins of, you know, Jacob, those who came out of Jacob, that language therefore refers to Jacob's direct seed, his sons, okay, and their children who are in direct lineal descent, okay? So it doesn't refer to other sons or other children who are sort of outside, who weren't, quote, in the loins of Jacob. If you look at Genesis 46:26 in this regard, let's just go there. 46:26. All the persons belonging to Jacob who came into Egypt, who were his own descendants. That's the same Hebrew term there. It's yatsah, to come out of. Not including Jacob's sons' wives. Okay, we're 66 persons in all. You actually get a different number there than the sons of Joseph. I mean, you can get to 70, which is what the passage does. But the key ideas are not including Jacob's sons' wives. You know, so we have an issue here. There's some artificiality to the number 70. If you want to take the language strictly for what it says, it refers only to those descendants who directly came from Jacob. It doesn't say anything about wives, you know, the women aren't included, so on and so forth. So it's not a real number. The real number is going to be a bit, you know, larger. So we have an indeterminate number. We don't actually know how many there were in reality, because you know, even if you went back and looked at the names of the wives of the sons of Jacob, you're going to find out that not all of them are listed. We don't get the wives for all of the sons, and you know, so on and so forth. We don't get a lot of information about who's actually, quote unquote, in Israel, who actually makes the trip with Jacob. So the number is artificial, and that's a problem, you know, for this sort of, well, you know, God knew, you know, omnisciently, you know, how many. And the reason it's a problem is because the other view, sons of God, which is the one that was actually in the text to begin with, We have a concrete number there. We have 70, because all we need to do is count the nations, the known nations at the time in Genesis 10. Genesis 10 and 11, the Babel incident, from which the Deuteronomy 32 worldview, you know, springs. Those two chapters, you know, every biblical scholar who's ever, you know, drawn a breath knows that those two chapters are related, the table of nations and the division of the nations. It's very obvious. And so we have an actual real number there. And if we wanted to drill down, you know, into the larger Canaanite worldview, again, for polemic reasons, we would discover that the sons of El, the sons of, you know, El, the Canaanite El, you know, at Ugarit were 70. Again, these things aren't just coincidental and accidental, but we don't have a concrete number if we're going with sons of Israel, because we just don't know how many went down to Egypt. The number that we're given is artificial. It doesn't include, you know, a lot of the women, you know, folk, and there, if you wanted to be real picky, there could be some other outliers there too. So you have a disconnect there. I would also say the correspondence, you know, or the notion, maybe we say it better than that, the notion of, well, maybe God, you know, in his omniscience knew that there would be 70, you know, Israelites, you know, go down there. That's the point. None of that has any coherence at all when you get to Deuteronomy 32:43. And what I mean here is that the 70 Israelites, you know, being used to by some, not by Voyu, but by some, to deny the sons of God reading in 32:8, they forget about verse 43, because the plural Elohim of verse 43 was also eliminated at some point in what would become the Masoretic text when verse 8 was the reference to the sons of God. So how do 70 Israelites account for what we read in Deuteronomy 32:43? Let me just read the passage again, because it's the same passage, the same textual issue in both places. And again, I point this out in my articles. I don't spend too much time on this in Unseen Realm, but in my journal articles I do. Verse 43 says, "Rejoice with him, O heavens," or "O heavenly ones, bow down to him, all gods," all Elohim. "For he judges the blood of his children and takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land." You know, it's a direct attack. It's a Deuteronomy 32 attack on the gods that seduced the Israelites way back earlier in the chapter, 32:8, 32:17. Again, if you're going to eliminate the supernatural element from verse 8, or say, well, that's really a reference to the Israelites, how is this a reference to the Israelites? How does it work in verse 43? And of course, the answer is it doesn't. Whereas the other view certainly does. And that would make sense, because verse 8, again, sons of God, and verse 43, the plural Elohim, that's what the text said. That's what was in the text. I could also ask, well, you know, if we have sons of Israel here, then where does Daniel get his theology? You know, Daniel 10, the prince of Persia, prince of Greece, you know, these supernatural princes that are opposing Israel's prince, Michael, you know, later called the archangel. You know, where does Daniel get this notion that empires, you know, earthly empires, behind those empires, there was a supernatural intelligence or power that was ultimately assigned to or attached to this geopolitical entity? Where does Daniel get that? Does he just like make it up? Just pops into his head? No, he gets it from Deuteronomy 32, the sons of God thing. If those are just humans, I don't know where Daniel's getting, you know, his theology. You know, you completely destroy the connection, which is actually important, because when Paul quotes Deuteronomy 32:17, he's talking about other Elohim, which the Septuagint has as demons, and that's in verse 17. And where does verse 17 in Deuteronomy 32 get the idea? Well, it gets it from the preceding verse in verse 8. Again, this is all a coherent whole that only makes sense if it's sons of God. And that's good, because guess what? That's what it was. According to all of our most ancient textual evidence, that's what it was. So, you know, and you could also say, well, Daniel gets his theology from Psalm 82. Well, that's wonderful. Where does the psalmist get it? in verse 8 when he asked God to rise up and take the nations as his inheritance. Well, I thought God owned everything. Well, actually, it makes sense if you allot the nations to other sons of God. So where does the psalmist get that idea if it was about Israelites? Again, you could make this idea, this trajectory, look dumb. Okay, let's just be honest. And I know that's not, you know, Voyo's, you know, trajectory, because he, you know, in his question, you know, he obviously, you know, understands the textual issue with the reading. But at the end of the day, omniscience has nothing to do with what was actually in the text. And to propose the alternative makes no sense at all for a number of these reasons.
Roy has a question about Luke 13:22-30. Just wondering Mike's take on few being saved. Jesus doesn't actually say that few will be saved in this Luke passage, but there are a number of other passages that seem to apply or say that the remnant will be few. Few will find it, workers are few, many called but few chosen, etc. Then the end of the Luke passage references the first being last and the last being first. So I guess what I'm wondering is, how few is few?
Well, the honest answer is I have no idea. You know, I can't assign a number, you know, or some kind of quantity when that information isn't given. I think the key though here is the, you know, Roy used the word remnant. God, you know, the people of God are always a subset of the rest of humanity. And I think it's quite clear they are a small subset. If you want to go back to, you know, our first question was Deuteronomy 32 worldview. Hey, it's one nation amid all the other ones. And even in that one nation, a lot of those people don't even wind up to be believers. They wind up forsaking, you know, their loyalty to the God of Israel, to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and go, you know, chasing after some other God. So even in that subset, there's a subset. So it's a small number, relatively speaking, you know, to the whole. But, you know, I can't quantify it in any other way than that. Remnant theology, you know, is something that runs through the entirety of the Bible. Again, this subset idea. So, you know, I'll throw out one other thought here. You know, since remnant theology does run through scripture, it's one of the reasons why I wonder about the general coherence of universalism. But that's, you know, that's a different subject. But the pattern is always the opposite of universalism, you know, if I could put it that way. So I think patterns are important. They teach us some things. And this one is quite regular.
All right, Rob has a question, and if ancient people were so wrong about the earth being inside of a dome holding back chaotic waters, why should I accept their views on supernatural beings or unseen realm as being correct? I'm struggling to be consistent in how I interpret the Bible. So they were wrong about the physical world, but correct about the spiritual world. How do I reconcile this?
Well, a fuller answer to this is on my website. It's under the FAQ, drmsh.com. Look at the FAQ, and it's the last question in the FAQ. So I'm not going to repeat that here. People who are listening to this episode can just go up and read it in a couple sentences. The reason, or how you approach this, is that the natural world is subject to the tools of science and the tools of human inquiry. Okay, because we are part of the creation and we have the faculties to examine the creation and learn about it. None of that is true in the spiritual world. The spiritual world is not subject to the tools of science. It is not subject to human inquiry. Why? Because we're not part of it. So there's a fundamental disconnect between what is said and how, you know, what is said about the natural world by people, by human writers. Their knowledge is quite limited, even in the world that they belong to. It's ultra limited, as in basically non-existent, when it comes to the spiritual world. The only way people know anything about the spiritual world is what God reveals to them. It is not discoverable with human faculties. And so that is the fundamental difference. And that's why the two conclusions can cohere together. But again, for more, just go up to drmsh.com, look under FAQ, and it's the last question.
Ross wants to know, why are the sons of God who committed sin in Genesis 6 called sons of God, in Genesis 6 called angels in the New Testament, like Jude 6 and 2 Peter 2:4, and not sons of God, if they are different, which we know they are?
Well, they're not different. This is a misunderstanding of terminology. You know, an angel is a different term. It's a job description. Sons of God is not a job description. It is a description of rank. So over in the spiritual world, all inhabitants of the spiritual world, they get referred to sometimes by what I would call ontological terms, terms that tell you what they are. They are spirits, for instance. Okay, they are Elohim. Okay, they're all this. But they can get called different things to either convey what they do or where they rank. So they're not different entities. They might have different rank. They might have different jobs. You know, let me use myself as an example. I can be referred to as man, husband, father, son, uncle, leader, servant, boss, and employee in the same paragraph. But it's still just me. Okay, those terms, and there are ontological terms in that list I just gave you, and there are functional terms in that list. The different terms don't mean that every term refers to a different person, or in this case, the different terminology used of the rebels of Genesis 6 don't mean that they're different groups. You know, in addition, Peter's getting his vocabulary from the Septuagint, Greek translation of the Old Testament. In Genesis 6:2, that's what it reads. It reads angels. He's writing in Greek, so that's what he uses. In my angels book, I discuss in the first chapter these terminological buckets, and I think there's a lot of confusion in this regard, and I think that's sort of at the heart of this question.
Ross also wants to know, does Psalm 8:5, where humankind is called a little less than the angels, which in the original is Elohim, makes angels and Elohim interchangeable?
Yeah, the answer again is the Septuagint. The vocabulary in the Hebrew Bible, the Hebrew terminology, was a lot more varied and a lot more nuanced than, you know, Greek. I mean, as the Hebrew Bible gets translated into Greek, you know, that's the Septuagint in the Second Temple or the intertestamental period, the translators there don't always have a different Greek term for each Hebrew term. They begin to start using angelos, angel, as just sort of an umbrella, a catch-all term. Well, he's talking now about some, you know, member of the heavenly host. We'll just call that an angel. So that's what happens, you know, in the course of putting the Hebrew Bible into Greek translation. And since New Testament writers, like the author of Hebrews, are going to be using the Septuagint, they don't correct it. They don't, you know, alter it. They use the Septuagint. This is the Bible that the people they're writing to are going to be reading, because everybody in the first century world that was literate could read Greek. You can't say that about Hebrew. That was definitely a minority reading language, even in the Jewish community, where the main language was Aramaic. You know, by this time, it was not Hebrew. Hebrew, of course, is going to be retained by the religious class, the scribes and the Pharisees and all that, you know, the sort of the more professional class. But the average person is either going to be reading the Septuagint, which, again, everybody reads Greek, or they're going to be reading a Targum, which is an Aramaic translation. So this is just a phenomenon of translation.
Our next question is from Dave. In Psalm 8:4-5, it says of man, "Yet you have made him a little lower than the heavenly beings and crowned him with glory and honor." How would an Israelite think of this in a divine council worldview? Is the concept "made him a little lower" more about location on the earth, or does it have to do with the position and authority? Is there some connection to the position location of the Nakash?
Yeah, I think, you know, lower here is a way of just of saying lesser. You know, most scholars, and I'm in this bunch here, would take this ontologically, therefore. In other words, a supernatural being, Psalm 8 has, you know, Elohim, a little lower than the Elohim, a supernatural being is superior to an embodied earthly being. So I take it as an ontological statement. The reference wouldn't be related to God's presence because God was present in Eden. So it's not, you know, like a, it's not a distance thing, you know, from God. You know, heaven is a lot higher than the earth if we want to even conceptualize it physically. So that really doesn't fit. Again, there's no distance factor here because God was present with these beings he created, even though they're lower, they're lesser. So I don't think there's a distance factor here. You know, even going with the, you know, taking, you know, the heavenly idea or, you know, the presence of God idea metaphorically, the spiritual world, let's just broaden it to the spiritual world. To refer to the heavenlies or something like that. I mean, again, that's a lot different than the physical world, but that world and the physical world are sort of combined, you know, in Eden because God has come to earth. So I think the only thing that really fits is the ontological perspective. Again, a little lower than the Elohim means just lesser. You know, and you could say a little lower. Well, okay. You know, how much is little, how much is much? I think the little there is, I think it's worded that way because God does create humanity, you know, in or as his image. So the language is designed to communicate both a similarity, but also, again, just a lower, lesser ontological status. And lastly, I don't think this has anything to do with the Nakash specifically, because it's a statement about humanity's created status. It's not a post-fall statement. It's not something that would be said in the context of Genesis 3. It's something that is stated in the context of human creation.
Our next two questions are from Matthew from Appleton, Wisconsin. Why is there an apocryphal tradition in the different versions of Life of Adam and Eve of Cain being born with some kind of glow or skin radiance? How does this relate to 1 Enoch, where Noah is born glowing and talking? In the Enochian narrative, Lamech, Noah's father, is afraid that his newborn son is a product of the Watchers. Were Second Temple Jews drawing the same conclusion about Cain? Is this a byproduct of their understanding of Genesis 4:1, or is there something else at play?
You know, I have my pseudepigrapha open, the Charlesworth edition, you know, for the sake of this Q&A, and searching for all of the references in, you know, for Cain in the Life of Adam and Eve, either the Greek version or the Latin version, at least the versions that are in Charlesworth's pseudepigrapha. And I can't find any reference to what Matthew's talking about Cain being born with glowing skin. So I guess that's my answer. I don't, you know, I would need some kind of passage reference because I'm just not seeing a single example. Now, that's a whole lot different than Noah in 1 Enoch. That's very clear. It's, in fact, for those who are interested in this, it's 1 Enoch chapter 106. And I'll read a little bit from Nicholsburg here, his commentary on Enoch about this description of Noah. In fact, why don't we just so that people can sort of get a little feel for this, let me just open up Charlesworth here to Enoch instead of Life and Adam and Eve, and I'll just read a little bit of this because this, I mean, there's no ambiguity in this instance, whereas the other one, like I said, I can't really find a single reference to this. But 106, Enoch says, after some days, my son Methuselah took a wife for his son Lamech, and she became pregnant by him and bore him a son, and his body was white as snow and red as a rose, which is, how can you be both white and red? Maybe it's pinkish in places, who knows? The hair of his head as white as wool, and his, it's a foreign word, dem-dema, was beautiful. That term, dem-dema, is sort of, there's really no English equivalent, but it's going to sound funny, but it refers to a big head of curly hair. So if you're thinking like an afro, that's essentially what it is. But you know, his demdema was beautiful. And as for his eyes, when he opened them, the whole house glowed like the sun. Rather, the whole house glowed even more exceedingly. And then it goes on to describe Noah and just the gloriousness of his face. You know, down in verse 5, his eyes are like rays of the sun. His face is glorious. And then in verse 6, it does not seem to me, his dad says, it does not seem to me that he is of me, but of angels. And I fear that a wondrous phenomenon may be, you know, may take place upon the earth in his days. So, you know, this sort of freaks dad out. You know, to see, you know, Noah in 1 Enoch 106. So this is what Matthew's talking about in his question. But there's nothing like this that I can find of used of Cain in Life of Adam and Eve. So I would need a verse reference. But back to Nicholsburg. Nicholsburg sort of summarizes 1 Enoch 106 this way. He says, Lamech reacts in terror to what he perceives to be the incarnation of a forbidden angelic conception. But he learns that the child's unearthly beauty is actually symbolic of his divinely sanctioned salvific function. So later on in 1 Enoch 106, these things are symbols of Noah's righteousness and basically his destiny to preserve humanity through the flood. Nicholsburg adds, noteworthy, especially in 1Q AP Genesis 2, that's the Genesis Apocryphon, which is another story besides chapter 106 of Enoch, where Lamech and his wife, you know, Lamech wonders, hey, is this my kid or is it, you know, from the Watchers? It's another kind of text like that. So especially in the Genesis Apocryphon, notable is the similarity between Lamech's suspicion of his wife and Joseph's concern about Mary's mysterious pregnancy in Matthew 1. So Nicholsburg compares those a little bit. He says, in addition, in both sets of stories, the supernatural conception of the child is at issue. In the Noah stories, a forbidden supernatural conception is denied. In Matthew and Luke, a conception by the Holy Spirit is affirmed. Strikingly, the canonical accounts, you know, the Matthew and Luke, the gospel accounts, about Jesus' birth are completely lacking in the kind of legendary details about the child's appearance that are present in the Noah story, unquote. So I think that's worth pointing out. You know, this is, again, the kind of internet theology you'll get. Well, you know, you know, Jesus' birth is just like, you know, what happens with Noah in the book of Enoch. Well, actually, it's not. It's quite a bit different. So I thought it was worth adding that detail from Nicholsburg. So I don't know how else to proceed with this question because, like I said, I just searched for the name Cain in the Life of Adam and Eve, and I don't have anything. You know, I can't find anything that sounds like what I just read about Noah from 1 Enoch 106.
Matthew's second question is, Isaiah 43:3-4 uses language that made me wonder if it is intended to be a hyperlink to Deuteronomy 32 and Yahweh's disinheritance of the nations and his choosing creation of Israel. I noticed in the very next chapter, Isaiah 44:2, that Isaiah uses the term Yeshurun for Israel. This term is found only in Deuteronomy 32 and 33. Is there something here?
Yeah, I actually have two studies on this. They're, you know, one is a journal article, the other one is a chapter from a book. And so I went back, you know, and looked at this. Let me read the titles because I'll stick them both in the protected folder if people are interested in reading these. One is by Ronald Berge. It's called The Song of Moses, which is Deuteronomy 32, and Isaianic Prophecies, A Case of Early Intertextuality, And then the other one is by Hyun Chul Paul Kim. The chapter is called The Song of Moses in Isaiah 40-55. And that's in a book called God's Word for Our World, Biblical Studies in Honor of Simon John DeVries, which is a 2004 title. Neither of those studies note any connection or suggest any connection for Isaiah 43, verses 3 and 4. And if you actually look at the passage, I wouldn't expect any because both of these studies are linguistically oriented. In other words, they're looking for actual vocabulary in the Hebrew text. Let me just read Isaiah 43, 3 and 4 so that people don't wonder why the question was asked and why I'm saying it this way. So Isaiah 43, verse 3 says, "For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. I give Egypt as your ransom. Cush and Sabah are in exchange for you. because you are precious in my eyes and honored, and I love you. I give men in return for you, peoples in exchange for your life. So you could read that as sort of this idea of Yahweh taking Israel as his own. That's Deuteronomy 4, 19 and 20, parallels Deuteronomy 32, 8. And by definition, sort of giving away, you know, some of these other countries. And I think that's what Matthew's question is about. But you don't have any actual vocabulary connections between those two verses in Hebrew and back in Deuteronomy 32. So I'm not surprised that neither of these studies note this, even though you could read it and sort of imagine a conceptual connective idea. I think there's probably a better, there are better ways to interpret the language of Isaiah 43 than to reference Deuteronomy 32. But just going with these studies, again, they're linguistically oriented, and so I'm not surprised that they didn't note this. However, the Jeshurun example, again, from Isaiah 44:2, and that term is only found elsewhere in Deuteronomy 32 and 33, they both note that connection. I mean, that seems to be, you know, much more explicit, again, because of the vocabulary connections. So I'm going to read a little section from Kim, and he comments about Jeshurun here. He says, concerning the echoes of Jacob, again, that's a term obviously for Israel, or Israel for Jacob, and Jeshurun in Deuteronomy 32 and Deutero-Isaiah, again, Isaiah 44. It is true, he says, that the term and notion of Jacob cannot be seen as anything unique. Admittedly, Israel has been called Jacob in numerous parts of the Hebrew Bible, all the more in prophetic literature, and he just proceeds to give us a grocery list of references. And he says, nonetheless, as the simple name Jacob, along with Israel, often depicts the mysterious servant in Deutero-Isaiah, the significance of this name in the Song of Moses cannot be quickly dismissed, where the name likewise conveys both individual and collective nuances. So let me just stop there. So he's noting here that Jacob and Israel, again, there's both a collective and an individual sense. And then he shifts to Jeshurun, which is hardly ever used. So there's a little bit of a nuance there. He says, more importantly, this name occurs, Jacob and Israel, with the peculiar name Jeshurun. So that helps identify it. In Deuteronomy 32, 14 and 15, and Isaiah 44, 2, the name Jeshurun occurs only in two other places in the Hebrew Bible, Deuteronomy 33, 5 and Deuteronomy 33, 26. In all these passages, the names of Jacob and Jeshurun occur in parallel. In addition to the fact that these appellations occur in pairs, both names are associated with the imagery of Yahweh's nurturing and fostering of Yahweh's people. Again, he has some citations there. It is possible and likely that the names Jeshurun paired with Jacob are commonly used in other traditions and transmissions. In the extant canonical shape, you know, the Hebrew Bible as we have it, finding such a parallel only in these two sources is remarkable. Calling and identifying Jacob as Yahweh's allotted inheritance and the archaic name Jeshurun simultaneously demonstrates that one author may have been well aware of and quite possibly or even deliberately alluding to the other author. So I'll just stop there. So that, I mean, that's Kim's way of saying, yeah, there's got to be a connection here. I mean, one, you know, Isaiah pretty much has to have Deuteronomy 32 and Deuteronomy 33 in mind to use this unusual term. So in regard to the second one, yep, there's a connection there that takes us back into Deuteronomy 32, specifically the allotment idea. But as far as the previous one, the earlier other citation, Isaiah 43, 3 and 4, neither of these studies think there's anything to that.
All right, Mike, another good round of questions. And don't forget, you can send me your questions at treystrickland@gmail.com or trey@nakedbible.com. And I'll put them in the queue. So again, we apologize. We can't get to everybody. We've got tons of them, but I do my best to try to pick them out. So there you go.
Yep.
Well, Mike, I wanted to bring up some happy news, and that is I was just looking around at our stats out there. It's just iTunes specific, but I noticed that we were actually in the Christian category.
That's good.
Yeah, we were ranked number 7th in Ireland, number 4th in Poland, and number 4th in New Zealand, and we were actually the number 1 Christian podcast in Slovakia.
Sweet.
How cool is that?
So that's pretty cool.
That is
cool. All that's pretty cool. I mean, when you really think about the geography there, wow.
Yeah, and then
that's
also
crazy.
And not just that, but in Slovakia, we were 44th in all of podcasts in its entirety. And also in South Africa, we were 200 in all of the podcasts in its entirety. And in the Philippines, we were 138th of all podcasts out there in the world. That's crazy.
So, yeah, that is.
So
that is.
We appreciate those countries listening to us. So shout out to
them. Absolutely.
To all of them, yeah. Slovakia.
Yeah, that's making it's remarkable.
We appreciate everybody out there listening to us. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Mike. Well, again, from your number one podcast in Slovakia, thanks again for listening.
Right.
Thanks for everybody out there listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.